Selden said with desperate softness, "It is you, sire, who insist on impossibilities." "Let me test you, man. Suppose I asked you to use your mathematics to tell me whether I would some day be assassinated. What would you say?" "My mathematical system would not give an answer to so specific a question, even if psychohistory worked at its best. All the quantum mechanics in the world cannot make it possible to predict the behavior of one lone electron, only the average behavior of many." "You know your mathematics better than I do. Make an educated guess based on it. Will I some day be assassinated?"
Selden said softly, "You lay a trap for me, sire. Either tell me what answer you wish, and I will give it to you, or else give me free right to make what answer I wish without punishment."
"Speak as you will."
"Your word of honor?"
"Do you want it in writing?"
Cleon was sarcastic. "Your spoken word of honor will be sufficient," said Selden, his heart sinking, for he was not certain it would be.
"You have my word of honor."
"Then I can tell you that in the past 4 centuries, nearly half the emperors have been assassinated, from which I conclude that the chances of your assassination are roughly 1 in 2.
"Any fool can give that answer," said Cleon with contempt. "It takes no mathematician."
"Yet I have told you several times that my mathematics is useless for practical problems."
"Can't you even suppose that I learn the lessons that have been given me by my unfortunate predecessors?"
Selden took a deep breath and plunged in. "No, sire. All history shows that we do not learn from the lessons of the past. For instance, you have allowed me here in a private audience. What if it were in my mind to assassinate you? Which it isn't, sire," he added hastily. Cleon smiled without humor.
"My man, you don't take into account our thoroughness or advances in technology. We have studied your history, your complete record. When you arrived, you were scanned. Your expression and voice prints were analyzed. We knew your emotional state in detail. We practically knew your thoughts. Had there been the slightest doubt of your harmlessness, you would not have been allowed near me. In fact, you would not now be alive."
A wave of nausea swept through Selden, but he continued. "Outsiders have always found it difficult to get at emperors, even with technology less advanced. However, almost every assassination has been a palace coup. It is those nearest the emperor who are the greatest danger to him. Against that danger, the careful screening of outsiders is irrelevant. And as for your own officials, your own guardsmen, your own intimates, you cannot treat them as you treat me." Cleon said,
"I know that too, and at least as well as you do. The answer is that I treat those about me fairly, and I give them no cause for resentment."
"A foolish," began Selden, who then stopped in confusion.
"Go on," said Cleon angrily. "I have given you permission to speak freely. How am I foolish?"
"The word slipped out, sire. I meant irrelevant. Your treatment of your intimates is irrelevant. You must be suspicious. It would be inhuman not to be. A careless word, such as the one I used, a careless gesture, a doubtful expression, and you must withdraw a bit with narrowed eyes. And any touch of suspicion sets in motion a vicious cycle. The intimate will sense and resent the suspicion, and will develop a changed behavior, try as he might to avoid it. You sense that, and grow more suspicious. And in the end, either he is executed or you are assassinated. It is a process that has proved unavoidable for the emperors of the past 4 centuries. And it is but one sign of the increasing difficulty of conducting the affairs of the empire.
Then nothing I can do will avoid assassination?
No, sire, said Selden. But on the other hand, you may prove fortunate. Cleon's fingers were drumming on the arm of his chair. He said harshly,
You are useless, man, and so is your psycho-history. Leave me.
And with these words, the emperor looked away, suddenly seeming much older than his 32 years. I have said my mathematics would be useless to you, sire. My profound apologies. Selden tried to bow, but at some signal he did not see, 2 guards entered and took him away. Cleon's voice came after him from the royal chamber.
Return that man to the place from which he was brought earlier.
Four.
Ato Demerzel emerged and glanced at the emperor with a hint of proper deference. He said, Sire, you have almost lost your temper. Cleon looked up and with obvious effort managed to smile.
Well, so I did. The man was very disappointing.
And yet he promised no more than he offered.
He offered nothing.
And promised nothing, sire.
It was disappointing.
Demerzel said, More than disappointing, perhaps. The man is a loose cannon, sire.
A loose what, Demerzel? You are always so full of strange expressions. What is a cannon?
Demerzel said gravely, It is simply an expression I heard in my youth, sire. The empire is full of strange expressions, and some are unknown on Trantor, as those of Trantor are sometimes unknown elsewhere.
Do you come to teach me the empire is large? What do you mean by saying that the man is a loose cannon?
Only that he can do much harm without necessarily intending it. He does not know his own strength or importance.
You deduce that, do you, Demerzel?
Yes, sire. He is a provincial. He does not know Trantor or its ways. He has never been on our planet before, and he cannot behave like a man of breeding, like a courtier. Yet he stood up to you.
And why not? I gave him permission to speak. I left off ceremony. I treated him as an equal.
Not entirely, sir. You don't have it within you to treat others as equals. You have the habit of command. And even if you tried to put a person at his ease, there would be few who could manage it. Most would be speechless, or worse, subservient and sycophantic. This man stood up to you.
Well, you may admire that, Demerzel, but I didn't like him.
Cleon looked thoughtfully discontented.
Did you notice that he made no effort to explain his mathematics to me? It was as though he knew I would not understand a word of it.
Nor would you have, sire. You are not a mathematician, nor a scientist of any kind, nor an artist. There are many fields of knowledge in which others know more than you. It is their task to use their knowledge to serve you. You are the emperor, which is worth all their specializations put together.
Is it? I would not mind being made to feel ignorant by an old man who had accumulated knowledge over many years. But this man, Selden, is just my age,
How does he know so much? He has not had to learn the habit of command, the art of reaching a decision that will affect the lives of others. Sometimes, demoiselle, I wonder if you are laughing at me.
Sire, said demoiselle reproachfully.
But never mind. Back to that loose cannon of yours. Why should you consider him dangerous? He seems a naive provincial to me.
He is, but he has this mathematical development of his.
He says it's useless.
You thought it might be useful. I thought so after you had explained it to me. Others might. The mathematician may come to think so himself, now that his mind has been focused on it. And who knows, he may yet work out some way of making use of it. If he does, then to foretell the future, however mistily, is to be in a position of great power. Even if he does not wish power for himself, a kind of self-denial that always seems to me to be unlikely, he might be used by others.
I tried to use him. He would not.
He had not given it thought. Perhaps now he will. And if he was not interested in being used by you, might he not be persuaded by, let us say, the mayor of Y?
Why should he be willing to help Y and not us?
As he explained, it is hard to predict the emotions and behavior of individuals. Cleon scowled and sat in thought.
Do you really think he might develop this psychohistory of his to the point where it is truly useful? He is so certain he cannot.
He may, with time, decide he was wrong in denying the possibility. Cleon said,
Then I suppose I ought to have kept him.
Demoiselle said, No, sire. Your instinct was correct when you let him go. Imprisonment, however disguised, would cause resentment and despair, which would not help him either to develop his ideas further or make him eager to help us. Better to let him go as you have done, but to keep him forever on an invisible leash. In this way, we can see that he is not used by an enemy of yourself, sire, and we can see that when the time comes and he has fully developed his science, we can pull on our leash and bring him in. Then we could be more persuasive.
But what if he is picked up by an enemy of mine, or better, of the Empire, for I am the Empire after all, or if, of his own accord, he wishes to serve an enemy? I don't consider that out of the question, you see.
Nor should you. I will see to it that this doesn't happen. But if, against all striving, it does happen, it would be better if no one has him than if the wrong person does. Cleon looked uneasy.
I'll leave that all in your hands, demoiselle. But I hope we're not too hasty. He could be, after all, nothing but the purveyor of a theoretical science that does not and cannot work.
Quite possibly, sire. But it would be safer to assume the man is, or might be, important. We lose only a little time, and nothing more if we find that we have concerned ourselves with a non-entity. We may lose a galaxy if we find we have ignored someone of great importance.
Very well, then, said Cleon. But I trust I won't have to know the details if they prove unpleasant.
Demoiselle said, Let us hope that will not be the case.
5.
Selden had had an evening, a night, and part of a morning to get over his meeting with the Emperor. At least the changing quality of light within the walkways, moving corridors, squares, and parks of the Imperial sector of Trantor made it seem that an evening, a night, and part of a morning had passed. He sat now in a small park on a small plastic seat that molded itself neatly to his body, and he was comfortable. Judging from the light, it seemed to be mid-morning, and the air was just cool enough to seem fresh, without possessing even the smallest bite. Was it like this all the time? He thought of the gray day outside when he went to see the Emperor. And he thought of all the gray days and cold days and hot days and rainy days and snowy days on Helicon, his home. And he wondered if one could miss them. Was it possible to sit in a park on Trantor, having ideal weather day after day, so that it felt as though you were surrounded by nothing at all, and coming to miss a howling wind or a biting cold or a breathless humidity? Perhaps, but not on the first day, or the second, or the seventh. He would have only this one day, and he would leave tomorrow. He meant to enjoy it while he could. He might, after all, never return to Trantor. Still, he continued to feel uneasy at having spoken as independently as he had to a man who could at will order one's imprisonment or execution, or at the very least, the economic and social death of loss of position and status. Before going to bed, Selden had looked up Cleon the First in the encyclopedic portion of his hotel room computer. The Emperor had been highly praised, as no doubt had all emperors in their own lifetime, regardless of their deeds. Selden had dismissed that, but he was interested in the fact that Cleon had been born in the palace, and had never left its grounds. He had never been in Trantor itself, in any part of the multi-domed world. It was a matter of security, perhaps, but what it meant was that the Emperor was in prison, whether he admitted the matter to himself or not. It might be the most luxurious prison in the galaxy, but it was a prison just the same. And though the Emperor had seemed mild-mannered, and had shown no sign of being a bloody-minded autocrat, as so many of his predecessors had been, it was not good to have attracted his attention. Selden welcomed the thought of leaving tomorrow for Helicon, even though it would be winter, and a rather nasty one so far, back home. He looked up at the bright, diffuse light. Although it could never rain in here, the atmosphere was far from dry. A fountain played not far from him. The plants were green, and had probably never felt drought. Occasionally, the shrubbery rustled, as though a small animal or two was hidden there. He heard the hum of bees. Really, though Trantor was spoken of throughout the galaxy as an artificial world of metal and ceramic, in this small patch it felt positively rustic. There were a few other persons taking advantage of the park, all wearing light hats, some quite small. There was one rather pretty young woman not far away, but she was bent over a viewer, and he could not see her face clearly. A man walked past, looked at him briefly and incuriously, then sat down in a seat facing him, and buried himself in a sheaf of teleprints, crossing one leg, in its tight pink trouser leg over the other. There was a tendency to pastel shades among the men, oddly enough, while the women mostly wore white. Being a clean environment, it made sense to wear light colors. He looked down in amusement at his own Heliconian costume, which was predominantly dull brown. If he were to stay on Trantor, as he was not, he would need to purchase suitable clothing, or he would become an object of curiosity, or laughter, or repulsion. The man with the teleprints had, for instance, looked up at him more curiously this time, no doubt intrigued by his outworldish clothing. Selden was relieved that he did not smile. He could be philosophical over being a figure of fun, but surely he could not be expected to enjoy it. Selden watched the man rather unobtrusively, for he seemed to be engaged in some sort of internal debate. At the moment he looked as if he was about to speak, then seemed to think better of it, then seemed to wish to speak again. Selden wondered what the outcome would be. He studied the man. He was tall, with broad shoulders, and no sign of a paunch. Darkish hair with a glint of blonde. Smooth-shaven, a grave expression, an air of strength, though there were no bulging muscles. A face that was a touch rugged, pleasant, but with nothing pretty about it. By the time the man had lost the internal fight with himself, or won, perhaps, and leaned toward him, Selden had decided he liked him. The man said, "Pardon me, weren't you at the decennial convention? Mathematics?" "Yes, I was," said Selden agreeably. "Ah, I thought I saw you there. It was, excuse me, that moment of recognition that led me to sit here. If I am intruding on your privacy—" "Not at all. I'm just enjoying an idle moment." "Let's see how close I can get. You're Professor Selden." "Selden. Harry Selden. Quite close. And you?" "Chetter Hummin." The man seemed slightly embarrassed. "Rather a homespun name, I'm afraid." "I've never come across any Chetters before," said Selden, "or Hummins. So that makes you somewhat unique, I should think. It might be viewed as being better than being mixed up with all the countless Harrys there are, or Seldens for that matter." Selden moved his chair closer to Hummin, scraping it against the slightly elastic ceramoid tiles. "Talk about homespun," he said. "What about this outworldish clothing I'm wearing? It never occurred to me that I ought to get Trantorian garb." "You could buy some," said Hummin, eyeing Selden with suppressed disapproval. "I'll be leaving tomorrow, and besides, I couldn't afford it. Mathematicians deal with large numbers sometimes, but never in their income. I presume you're a mathematician, Hummin." "No, zero talent there." "Oh." Selden was disappointed. "You said you saw me at the decennial convention." "I was there as an onlooker. I'm a journalist." He waved his teleprints, seemed suddenly aware that he was holding them, and shoved them into his jacket pouch. "I supply the material for the news holocasts." Then, thoughtfully, "Actually, I'm rather tired of it."
"The job?"
Hummin nodded.
"I'm sick of gathering together all the nonsense from every world. I hate the downward spiral."
He glanced speculatively at Selden.
"Sometimes something interesting turns up, though. I've heard you were seen in the company of an Imperial Guard and making for the palace gate. You weren't by any chance seen by the Emperor, were you?"
The smile vanished from Selden's face. He said slowly, "If I was, it would scarcely be something I could talk about for publication."
"No, no, not for publication. If you don't know this, Selden, let me be the first to tell you. The first rule of the news game is that nothing is ever said about the Emperor or his personal entourage except what is officially given out. It's a mistake, of course, because rumors fly that are much worse than the truth, but that's the way it is."
"But if you can't report it, friend, why do you ask?"
"Private curiosity.
Believe me, in my job I know a great deal more than ever gets on the air. Let me guess.
I didn't follow your paper.
But I gathered that you were talking about the possibility of predicting the future. Selden shook his head and muttered, "It was a mistake."
"Pardon me?"
"Nothing." "Well, prediction, accurate prediction, would interest the Emperor, or any man in government. So I'm guessing that Cleon, first of that name, asked you about it, and wouldn't you please give him a few predictions?" Selden said stiffly, "I don't intend to discuss the matter." Hummin shrugged slightly.
"Ato Demerzel was there, I suppose."
"Who?"
"You've never heard of Ato Demerzel?"
"Never."
"Cleon's alter ego, Cleon's brain, Cleon's evil spirit. He's been called all those things, if we confine ourselves to the non-vituperative. He must have been there."
Selden looked confused, and Hummin said,
"Well, you may not have seen him, but he was there. And if he thinks you can predict the future..."
"I can't predict the future," said Selden, shaking his head vigorously. "If you listen to my paper, you'll know that I only spoke of a theoretical possibility."
"Just the same, if he thinks you can predict the future, he will not let you go."
"He must have. Here I am."
"That means nothing. He knows where you are, and he'll continue to know. And when he wants you, he'll get you wherever you are. And if he decides you're useful, he'll squeeze the use out of you. And if he decides you're dangerous, he'll squeeze the life out of you."
Selden stared.
"What are you trying to do, frighten me?"
"I'm trying to warn you."
"I don't believe what you're saying."
"Don't you?
A while ago, you said something was a mistake. Were you thinking that presenting the paper was a mistake, and that it was getting you into the kind of trouble you don't want to be in?"
Selden bit his lower lip uneasily. That was a guess that came entirely too close to the truth. And it was at this moment that Selden felt the presence of intruders. They did not cast a shadow, for the light was too soft and widespread. It was simply a movement that caught the corner of his eye. And then it stopped.
Flight. Trentor, the capital of the First Galactic Empire. Under Cleon I, it had its twilight glow. To all appearances, it was then at its peak. Its land surface of 200 million square kilometers was entirely domed, except for the Imperial Palace area, and underlaid with an endless city that extended beneath the continental shelves. The population was 40 billion. And although the signs were plentiful, and clearly visible in hindsight, that there were gathering problems, those who lived on Trentor undoubtedly found it still the eternal world of legend, and did not expect it would ever... Encyclopedia Galactica.
6.
Selden looked up. A young man was standing before him, looking down at him with an expression of amused contempt. Next to him was another young man, a bit younger perhaps. Both were large and appeared to be strong. They were dressed in an extreme of Trantorian fashion, Selden judged. Boldly clashing colors, broad fringed belts, round hats with wide brims all about, and the two ends of a bright pink ribbon extending from the brim to the back of the neck. In Selden's eyes it was amusing, and he smiled. The young man before him snapped,
"What are you grinning at, misfit?"
Selden ignored the manner of address and said gently, "Please pardon my smile. I was merely enjoying your costume."
"My costume? So, and what are you wearing? What's that awful, awful you call clothes?"
His hand went out, and his finger flicked at the lapel of Selden's jacket. Disgracefully heavy and dull, Selden himself thought, in comparison to the other's light-hearted colors. Selden said, "I'm afraid it's my outworlder clothes. They're all I have." He couldn't help notice that the few others who were sitting in the small park were rising to their feet and walking off. It was as though they were expecting trouble and had no desire to remain in the vicinity. Selden wondered if his new friend Hummond was leaving too, but he felt it injudicious to take his eyes away from the young man who was confronting him. He teetered back on his chair slightly. The young man said,
"You an outworlder?"
"That's right. Hence my clothes."
"Hence? What kind of word's that? Outworld word?"
"What I meant was, that was why my clothes seem peculiar to you. I'm a visitor here."
"From what planet?"
"Helicon." The young man's eyebrows drew together.
"Never heard of it."
"It's not a large planet."
"Why don't you go back there?"
"I intend to. I'm leaving tomorrow."
"Sooner. Now."
The young man looked at his partner. Selden followed the look and caught a glimpse of Hummond. He had not left, but the park was now empty except for himself, Hummond, and the two young men. Selden said, "I thought I'd spend today sightseeing."
"No, you don't want to do that. You go home now."
Selden smiled. "Sorry, I won't." The young man said to his partner,
"You like his clothes, Marby?"
Marby spoke for the first time.
"No, disgusting, turns the stomach."
"Can't let him go around turning stomachs, Marby. Not good for people's health."
"No, not by no means, Alum," said Marby. Alum grinned.
"Well now, you heard what Marby said."
And now Hummond spoke. He said, "Look, you two, Alum, Marby, whatever your names are, you've had your fun. Why don't you go away?" Alum, who had been leaning slightly toward Selden, straightened and turned.
"Who are you?"
"That's not your business," snapped Hummond.
"You're Trantorian?"
asked Alum. "Also not your business." Alum frowned and said,
"You're dressed Trantorian. We're not interested in you, so don't go looking for problems."
"I intend to stay. That means there are two of us. Two against two doesn't sound like your kind of fight. Why don't you go away and get some friends so you can handle two people?"
Selden said, "I really think you ought to get away if you can, Hummond. It's kind of you to try to protect me, but I don't want you harmed."
"These are not dangerous people, Selden, just half-credit lackeys."
"Lackeys?"
The words seemed to infuriate Alum, so that Selden thought it must have a more insulting meaning on Trantor than it had on Helicon.
"Here, Marby," said Alum with a growl. "You take care of that other mother lackey, and I'll rip the clothes off this Selden. He's the one we want. Now."
His hands came down sharply to seize Selden's lapels and jerk him upright. Selden pushed away, instinctively it would seem, and his chair tipped backward. He seized the hand stretched toward him. His foot went up, and his chair went down. Somehow, Alum streaked overhead, turning as he did so, and came down hard on his neck and back behind Selden.
Selden twisted as his chair went down, and was quickly on his feet, staring down at Alum, then looking sharply to one side for Marby. Alum lay unmoving, his face twisted in agony. He had two badly sprained thumbs, excruciating pain in his groin, and a backbone that had been badly jarred. Hammond's left arm had grabbed Marby's neck from behind, and his right arm had pulled the other's right arm backward at a vicious angle. Marby's face was red as he labored uselessly for breath. A knife, glittering with a small laser inset, lay on the ground beside them. Hammond eased his grip slightly and said, with an air of honest concern, "You've hurt that one badly." Selden said, "I'm afraid so. If he had fallen a little differently, he would have snapped his neck." Hammond said, "What kind of a mathematician are you?" "A Heliconian one." He stooped to pick up the knife, and after examining it said, "Disgusting and deadly." Hammond said, "An ordinary blade would do the job without requiring a power source. But let's let these two go. I doubt they want to continue any further." He released Marby, who rubbed first his shoulder, then his neck. Gasping for air, he turned hate-filled eyes on the two men. Hammond said sharply, "You two had better get out of here. Otherwise, we'll have to give evidence against you for assault and attempted murder. This knife can surely be traced to you." Selden and Hammond watched while Marby dragged Alum to his feet and then helped him stagger away, still bent in pain. They looked back once or twice, but Selden and Hammond watched impassively. Selden held out his hand. "How do I thank you for coming to the aid of a stranger against two attackers? I doubt I would have been able to handle them both on my own." Hammond raised his hand in a deprecatory manner. "I wasn't afraid of them. They're just street-brawling lackeys. All I had to do was get my hands on them, and yours too, of course." "That's a pretty deadly grip you have," Selden mused. Hammond shrugged. "You too." Then, without changing his tone of voice, he said, "Come on, we'd better get out of here. We're wasting time." Selden said, "Why do we have to get away? Are you afraid those two will come back?" "Not in their lifetime. But some of those brave people who cleared out of the park so quickly in their eagerness to spare themselves a disagreeable sight may have alerted the police."
"Fine. We have the hoodlums' names, and we can describe them fairly well."
"Describe them? Why would the police want them?"
"They committed an assault."
"Don't be foolish. We don't have a scratch. They're virtually hospital bait, especially Alum. We're the ones who will be charged."
"But that's impossible. Those people witnessed the fact that..."
"No people will be called. Selden, get this into your head. Those two came to find you, specifically you.
They were told you were wearing Heliconian clothes, and you must have been described precisely.
Perhaps they were even shown a holograph. I suspect they were sent by the people who happened to control the police, so let's not wait any longer."
Hammond hurried off, his hand gripping Selden's upper arm. Selden found the grip impossible to shake, and feeling like a child in the hands of an impetuous nurse, followed. They plunged into an arcade, and before Selden's eyes grew accustomed to the dimmer light, they heard the burring sound of a ground car's brakes.
"There they are," muttered Hammond,
Faster, Selden.
They hopped onto a moving corridor and lost themselves in the crowd.
7.
Selden had tried to persuade Hammond to take him to his hotel room, but Hammond would have none of that.
Are you mad? He half-whispered. They'll be waiting for you there.
But all my belongings are waiting for me there, too.
They'll just have to wait.
And now they were in a small room in a pleasant apartment structure that might be anywhere, for all that Selden could tell. He looked about the one-room unit. Most of it was taken up by a desk and chair, a bed, and a computer outlet. There were no dining facilities or washstand of any kind, though Hammond had directed him to a communal washroom down the hall. Someone had entered before Selden was quite through. He had cast one brief and curious look at Selden's clothes, rather than at Selden himself, and had then looked away. Selden mentioned this to Hammond, who shook his head and said,
"We'll have to get rid of your clothes. Too bad Helicon is so far out of fashion."
Selden said impatiently, "How much of this might just be your imagination, Hammond? You've got me half convinced, and yet it may be merely a kind of... Are you groping for the word paranoia?"
"All right, I am. This may be some strange paranoid notion of yours."
Hammond said, "Think about it, will you? I can't argue it out mathematically, but you've seen the Emperor. Don't deny it. He wanted something from you, and you didn't give it to him. Don't deny that, either. I suspect that details of the future are what he wants, and you refused. Perhaps Demerzel thinks you're only pretending not to have the details, that you're holding out for a higher price, or that someone else is bidding for it, too. Who knows? I told you that if Demerzel wants you, he'll get you wherever you are. I told you that before those two splitheads ever appeared on the scene. I'm a journalist and a Trantorian. I know how these things go. At one point, Alum said, 'He's the one we want.' Do you remember that?"
"As it happens," said Selden, "I do."
"To him, I was only the other mother lackey to be kept off, while he went about the real job of assaulting you." Hammond sat down in the chair and pointed to the bed. "Stretch out, Selden. Make yourself comfortable. Whoever sent those two, it must have been Demerzel, in my opinion, can send others. So we'll have to get rid of those clothes of yours. I think any other Heliconian in this sector, caught in his own world's garb, is going to have trouble until he can prove he isn't you."
"Oh, come on." "I mean it. You'll have to take off the clothes, and we'll have to atomize them, if we can get close enough to a disposal unit without being seen. And before we can do that, I'll have to get you a Trantorian outfit. You're smaller than I am, and I'll take that into account. It won't matter if it doesn't fit exactly."
Selden shook his head. "I don't have the credits to pay for it, not on me. What credits I have, and they aren't much, are in my hotel safe."
"We'll worry about that another time. You'll have to stay here for an hour or two while I go out in search of the necessary clothing."
Selden spread his hands and sighed resignedly. "All right. If it's that important, I'll stay."
"You won't try to get back to your hotel? Word of honor?"
"My word as a mathematician."
"But I'm really embarrassed by all the trouble you're taking for me, and expense, too."
This book is continued on cassette number 2, side 1.